Would like to make a strong case for the specific exclusion of further mining of highly sensitive coastal zone habitats and the phased curtailment of current mining operations in such areas. And I specifically draw attention to known sensitive coastal zone habitats. Furthermore, the legislation should articulate explicitly that the Minister of Environment Affairs is a competent authority in terms of mining activities in the coastal zone. And I am fully aware of the fact that this has been an argument that's been going on for more than 15 years in terms of the two departments, but at every possible opportunity I will raise that issue with regard to the Department of Mineral Energy Affairs retaining power to make decisions over environmental issues. In terms of specific comments, Chair, I realise that some of these are of a minor nature. However, this is my opportunity on behalf of my organisation to raise these issues, and I hope that that the Portfolio Committee will bear with me in terms of some of these issues, which are, as I said, of a minor nature. And I will refer specifically to the bill. Members and other individuals don't have the bill with them, I will specify the section and read out the title of that section. So the first section that I would like to comment on is section 8, which relates to extending coastal public property. Let it please note the provision that coastal public property may be extended to include any state-owned land within the coastal zone. RESA urges the Minister to ensure that most state-owned land within the coastal zone is designated as coastal public property and suggests that immediate measures are put in place to prevent especially local authorities from attempting to rezone land, extend the urban edge, or to obtain revenue from the sale of trust-sensitive land in the interim period until the store is promulgated as law. The next section is section 13, access to coastal public property. The intention of the bill is to ensure that South Africans are able to exercise their right to access to coastal public property. The ownership of such is vested in them. The bill does not deal with the problem of citizens being denied access to coastal public property through the fencing off of private land that is adjacent to coastal public property. And I see it as a failing, and I will touch on this again when I come to section 18. And in section 13.4, also access to coastal public property. A public participation process should be obligatory before approval is granted for the imposition of a fee for access to coastal public property. And I believe that the word may should be replaced with the word must. In other words, if you are going to set fees for access to the coastline, I believe that communities in that area should participate in the decision around what exactly that fee will be. Section 14, position of the high water mark. Which is pleased to note, the area included in coastal public property will, in terms of the proposed act, be automatically adjusted to accommodate inward movement of the high water mark, and that accretion will not result in the reduction of the area included in coastal public property. Section 15, which is about measures affecting erosion and accretion. To date, owners and occupiers of land adjacent to the seashore have required organs of state to take measures to protect their properties from the effects of coastal erosion. RESA trusts that this clause in the bill will serve as a deterrent to building too close to the current shoreline. RESA also trusts that local authorities will be mindful of this clause when approving plans for development of land adjacent to the seashore. In other words, what we're saying is that if a local authority allows individuals to build that closely, we do not believe that at times of storms and with the sea rise and so on and so forth, as we have seen a lot of coastline at the moment in terms of continental coastline, that those local authorities should in fact be requested or even demanded that they give their time, effort and resources to protect that property. Section 18, designation of coastal access land. Section 18.1 states that, and I quote, each municipality whose area includes coastal public property must, within 4 years of commencement of this Act, make a bylaw that designates strips of land adjacent to that coastal public property as coastal access land in order to secure public access to that coastal public property. The bill appears to presuppose that municipalities, including district municipalities, own land that is suitable to be designated as coastal access land. This is not always the case, and increasingly landowners are using private land ownership of coastal land as a means of securing their own private beaches and denying the public access to the seashore. Large developments on the coastline, such as golfing estates, are particularly notorious in this regard. Wetter believes that the bill should make provision, where necessary, for the expropriation of land that will be designated as coastal access land so as to ensure that the public is able to access coastal public property. And I'm only referring to coastal public property here, state-owned land. In future, proponents of large-scale coastal developments should, as a condition of approval of the development, be required to cede land to the local authority for the purpose of access to coastal public property. It should be noted that in many cases, access to coastal public property by the public is a question of subsistence rather than leisure. In other words, many individuals are dependent upon that coastline for their livelihood and their survival. And while we see on land, in many instances, developers going into partnership with local authorities to cede certain portions of that land for conservation purposes, I believe that along the coastline there are very, very few examples of where potential developers have in fact entered into similar agreements to allow land to be given to local authorities so that the general public can gain access. Section 25, establishment of a coastal setback line. Wetter believes that the setback line in relation to coastal public property should be dealt with separately and not together with the coastal protection zone. In the case of coastal public property, MEC should be required to establish coastal setback lines to protect coastal public property, and that buildings should not be allowed to be erected on the seaward side of this setback line. All development proposals, either wholly or partially, within the coastal protected zone should, as a mandatory component of the development application, articulate a coastal setback line that conservatively limits the extent of seaward development. Section 26.3, determination and adjustment of coastal boundaries. This clause refers both to the determination and adjustment of the boundaries of coastal areas. It is unclear why coastal boundaries may be determined only under certain conditions. Wetter suggests that the word only be removed from this clause and that boundaries may be determined under certain conditions. Section 32.2, Natural Estuarine Management Protocol. Wetter is pleased to note that the Minister retains the responsibility for prescribing a National Estuarine Management Protocol, albeit with the concurrence of the Minister responsible for water affairs. Wetter believes most strongly that the ultimate responsibility for the management of estuaries should vest in the Minister for Environmental Affairs and not with the Minister of Water Affairs. Section 32.3, also National Estuarine Management Protocol. Many estuaries in South Africa are in a very poor condition and seriously degraded as a result of upstream pollution, discharge of effluent into estuaries, and development on the banks and floodplains of estuaries. And I'm dealing with an application at the moment for Weta believes that the national SRI management protocol should include stringent rehabilitation plans for degraded estuaries. Section 35.1, establishment and function of the National Coastal Committee. Weta believes that it is essential that the National Coastal Committee be established and thus the word may should be replaced with the word must. Elsewhere in the bill, mention is made of referring matters to the National Coastal Committee. It is thus assumed that such a committee will exist, and therefore the Minister should be obliged to see to its formation. The National Coastal Committee will perform essential participatory and information sharing functions, and I therefore would request that the Portfolio Committee give serious consideration to the suggestion that there not be a National Coastal Committee. Section 39.42, Provincial and Municipal Coastal Committee. It is difficult to understand how coastal management will be successfully integrated at all levels without the existence of these committees. Weta believes that the establishment of provincial coastal committees should be required in terms of the proposed act, as should municipal coastal committees, at least in terms of metropolitan municipalities. Section 48.4, Preparation and Adoption of Municipal Coastal Management Program. Weta supports the inclusion of coastal management programs as part of integrated development plans and spatial development frameworks that have been adopted in accordance with the Municipal Systems Act. Section 53, this is around consultation and public participation. Weta notes with pleasure that throughout the bill there is a commitment to public participation and consultative decision making. However, the section dealing with public participation has been considerably weakened since the initial draft of the bill, and this is disappointing. In particular, the removal of the following clauses is of grave concern, and I draw your attention to two clauses which you may not have noticed have disappeared from the latest bill. And I quote, firstly, the Minister, MEC, Municipality and other persons exercising that power must take account of the representations and objections received during the consultative process before exercising the power. And the second clause which has been omitted is as follows, a person exercising a power may allow interested or affected parties to make oral representations or objections in order to enable them to participate more effectively in the decision-making process. Close quote. While the first draft of the bill actively embodied and committed itself to meaningful public participation, the current draft has reduced such public participation to a perfunctory process in which the public does not necessarily believe it has any role in the decision-making process. It is particularly disappointing to note that the bill does not make provision for oral submissions, and therefore restricts some comments to those who are able to provide cogent written comments. In many coastal communities, there is a significant rate of illiteracy or semi-literacy, and restricting comments to the written format effectively excludes those often and most acutely affected by decisions from participating in such decisions. Section 58, duty to avoid causing adverse effects on coastal environments. Weta believes that a serious shortcoming of this section is the failure to consider cumulative impact of activities which individually, in themselves, may not qualify as having significant adverse effects. Now, quote, significant adverse effects. Weta urges that this shortcoming is remedied. In terms of land-based activities, we have strategic environmental assessments, and I don't see why there is not mention in the bill in terms of strategic environmental assessments assessing cumulative impact. Section 58.1a, also under duty to avoid causing adverse effects on coastal environments. The current phrasing of this clause is somewhat humorously ambiguous, where it suggests the following phraseology, and we would like to see that it's stated joining this call. Quote, any person who produced and we would like to see added or discharged a substance which caused or is causing. The cause goes on from there. So it's not only producing, it's also discharging. And there are many industries that produce and discharge. Section 65, repair or removal of structures within coastal zones. Wetter is pleased to note that the bill makes adequate provision for dealing effectively with abandoned structures where the owner cannot be identified, and I could add, often does not want to be found. Section 62.2, implementation of land use legislation in coastal zones, coastal protection zones. Wetter is pleased to note that, and I quote, an organ of state may not authorize land within the coastal protection zone to be used for any activity that may have an adverse effect on the coastal environment without first considering an environment impact assessment report. And I put emphasis on the phrase without first considering an environment impact assessment report. Wetter trusts that this commitment to requiring a prior environmental impact assessment report will be retained despite proposals that the National Environmental Management Act be amended to include decision-making tools other than environmental impact assessment. Wetter considers environmental impact assessment to be the only reliable and scientifically acceptable decision-making tool by which to judge proposed activities as contemplated in this section of the bill. Section 63.1b, integrated environmental authorization for coastal activities. Wetter commends the drafters of the bill for including this clause which considers the past record compliance of applicants. And we do know of applicants that have fouled up one part of the coastline, moved on, applied, for rights and filed up another area and moved on and applied for rights and so on and so forth. Section 69.1, discharge of effluent into coastal waters. Wetter believes that the content of this section is adequate in situations where the discharge of effluent and its assimilation has been regulated for a long time period. However, South Africa's coastline and estuaries have been subjected to unacceptable practices of discharge of effluent for many years, and remedial action is urgently required rather than holding action as articulated in this section. Municipalities are amongst the worst offenders in terms of unacceptable effluent discharge, and yet they will be allowed to continue this practice under general authorization. In addition, the construction of effluent pipelines that discharge into the sea has been poorly regulated for many years. Wetter believes that effluent pipelines must be subject to specific and stringent legal restrictions in order to remediate the cumulative adverse impact of past and current effluent discharge practices. The bill should distinguish between outfall pipelines on high energy coastlines and those in areas where the turnaround of water is slow, such as in pathway. The environmental risks are distinctly different in each case. In conclusion, thank you for the opportunity afforded Wetter to comment on this bill and its previous draft. While not perfect, the proposed legislation has much to commend it, and the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism is to be congratulated on the drafting of a comprehensive and cohesive document. Much of the required detail will follow with the promulgation of regulations, and in time, it will become more evident with the shortcomings of the legislation are. Significantly, this legislation represents a very strong commitment to the integrated management of our coastal zones. The implementation of such legislation is long overdue, and Wetter is of opinion that the promulgation of the Integrated Coastal Management Act should be regarded as an urgent priority. Thank you very much.
I'm very much impressed by the presenter and the social debate, and I can express also my I'm intrigued, however, by the fact that they are against the regulation here of the national coastal management committee. And that is an easy way. You are saying you don't pay them the national management committee system.
I'm saying that we believe very strongly that there should be a national coastal committee. But we believe that with the word may, such national coastal committee may not get off the ground. And we are also disappointed in terms of need. The National Environment Affairs. I'm not quite sure what we
said. Okay, sir, let's just step on that. Are you in favor of the national?
Yes. Yes, we are in favor.
Oh, fine. Then we're on the same page.
And just the word may. There's the word may there to be concerned about.
Any other comments? You raised the point that you do want to be any mining in the surface of coastal area.
That this should not come in at all.
Was that coming away from a trip?
And
you saw oil mining, gas mining in Amazon. But it's done in such a way that the competition became with the world. I think the Amazon is not a motor area of the world. But there is a conscious attempt every step of the way to ensure that the environment is completely left in the past.
We made the comment in terms of the coastal protection zone. So we accept that there is a need for mining for water, obviously, in terms of the coastal disaster. So we're not saying that there should be no coastal mining at all. However, coastal protection areas are very often designated in terms of the unique. And we don't believe that, for instance, diamond mining is such a unique issue. And we believe that it is highly destructive, and we would also question whether such an environment could be returned to a pristine nature once mining has been completed. But we're open to participating in environmental impact assessments on such sites, and we would study the inspection reports and the documentation, and if we satisfied that such sensitive environments can be returned to a pristine nature, then we would withdraw those objections.
Thanks, Chair. I'm clear on Wes's submission. What I would be interested in, and perhaps this is too large a question, but with all the goals we work on, we effectively in our minds have a certain problem statement. So the waste ball we're working on, we understand the problem. I would like to know if Mr. Gubb could give us a few minutes of his insight into, from a waste point of view, the coastal zone, challenges to it, from the point of view of how he sees development impacting on it, just in a sort of broad brushstroke approach, because I understand what his submissions are. It'll be good to get from an NGO point of view challenges that the coastal zone actually faces.
In relation to your position on mining of trees, do you have a position on the proposed mining on the Wild Coast, which is something that is being referred to our mines, and I imagine we could mine in that part of on that part of the coast.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, my question is also on the mining. I mean, this is obviously an issue that has come up in various guises to the committee. The issue, are you referring to the marine protected areas where you're saying that there shouldn't be mining? Now, one of the problems is this, is in that piece of legislation which was brought to this committee about three years ago, I think it was clear that the marine protected areas at that stage only go up to the high water mark. Now, the kind of proposed mining in the Eastern Cape occurs above the high water mark. So it strictly falls out of the marine protected area zone. Obviously, it is taking water from the estuary there, which is then feeding that marine protected area. Now, this is an issue which I think we need to look at, and perhaps this still is one of the areas to do that. How would you propose to deal with a situation like that? Because strictly speaking, I think that the marine protected area ends at the high water mark, but the mining goes above that. And so we need to kind of look at how we engage with buffer zones and things like that. I'd just be interested in your remarks, or maybe even Mr. Mikey's.
The one question I would like to ask, in the event that I think the LCM scope of your first column is, in terms of the definition of public property, hotel public property, what percentage of the South African shoreline can be defined as public property? And relatedly, there are these views from the homeland in the Eastern Cape, with all these river mouths like your Geisha, river mouth, etc. But it's been very confusing as to who really regulates those issues. Are they under the municipality that they coexist with? Are they under the district municipality, or who really, because it's very confusing. Because what if I visit the former sky? Once you pass the fish river, the middle of this thing is going to go around. But no one knows, I don't know who really, which part of local government could have an answer to do that. Can you comment on this, Sekam?
Thank you, Chair. Firstly,
the insight into coastal zone challenges with regards to my experience over the last 10 years. There's no doubt that the major impact is from coastal development. I think that the unfortunate issue is that many of those coastal developments are extremely upmarket. We know that on average they have an occupancy rate of between 12 and 15% any time of the year. And yes, it's very difficult to raise issues around the impact of those coastal developments because they're upmarket and they look extremely green and they have beautiful trees and a beautiful coastline. There are issues there in terms of impact, in terms of access or denying access. And also, many of those developments are not dependent upon a coastline for their positioning. I think that the coastline is such an important asset that we really need to look very carefully at how we use it. Because many of these developments, in terms of looking at the long-term conservation of our coastline, are in fact short-term in nature. So I would see that development is a major issue. And especially, as I said, the upmarket development end. And the impact that that's having, and especially with local authorities extending their urban edges and applying for amendments to structure plans and to special development frameworks and IDPs, which is what has been fairly common over the last 5 years. In fact, 2 years ago, we had one municipality that extended its municipal boundary by 70 kilometres, just to include Tiwi-Tree Golfing Estate. And we've just had the Golfing Estate being passed, which is on a pristine river, and the majority of the development is within the 150-year floodplain, and in fact it's Golfing Estate. And it seems such a pity to use that area so in such a way. So there are many impacts, but I would say the major one that we're facing is this major push to develop our coastline in terms of market development. Mining of dunes, the wild coast issue. West's position is that we do not believe that the mining of that section of the wild coast is in fact sustainable, and we do believe that it cannot be returned to its pristine nature, and we do not support that mining, and we also believe that it's not in the full interest of the communities that exist along that coastline. And we put the fact that and there are many documents that have been produced along those lines, and it is linked to in fact the huge road that links East London with Durban, so one can't uncouple those. But the short answer is that we don't support that mining. Thirdly, in terms of the committee versus council, we'd be very supportive of the terminology council, which you suggest. We believe that council, although it might not necessarily carry with it higher responsibility, it certainly sounds that it does carry that higher responsibility. So the highest level of responsibility that such a body could carry is the better, as far as we're concerned. Mining in terms of marine protected areas, I wasn't only referring to marine protected areas, although those are obviously in terms of the coastal protection zone. The clearly marine protected areas are within that, but also the coastal protection zone includes other sensitive environments that aren't statutory protected areas. And many of them have been identified by the department and the scientific community as being of critical importance in terms of often unique examples within the South African coastline. And we just believe that the mining of those areas for the short-term gain is a bad use of the biodiversity and often biophysical structures which are being targeted to be trying to protect in those areas. So, and then with regards to the estuary, yes, the extraction of water from estuaries is also a critical issue. And in terms of buffer zones, certainly we are fully supportive of the buffer zone that's been suggested by the department in terms of more urban areas having 100 meter buffer zone and rural areas up to 1,000 meters. We believe that that's critically important, although the minister does have the right to adjust that. And I'd like to add an issue here, which is not necessarily limited to this bill, but it comes out in that question in that we are quite concerned about many of the decisions being referred back to the minister. And we see over the last 5-10 years that their decision making is becoming more and more centralized in the minister, which often means in the sense of the top echelon of officials. And we hear an undermining of public participation in decision making. So wherever a bill suggests that there be a committee which draws upon the public, in terms of serving on those committees, we would always support that because we would like to open up the decision making beyond just the minister himself or herself. That's not really for me to change of the coastline in terms of coastal public property. I wouldn't know what the answer is to that.
Thank you, Chair. We welcome most of the remarks by the Senegal. And I will ask the Advocate Shabbat to respond to the specific questions that were asked. Let's go to the other questions. One, I think only for lack of people, not another for the next one.
If you look at the Kamakos, most of the towns, whether it's your Kekine, whatever, the most beautiful spot, I would say 90% of them, with the beautiful views, etc., are owned by white how would you help address the issue of equity? What position we have seen, it has been to the contamination. How do we ensure that the future of the country also enjoys both by dead people but also by working people? But I don't think that if working white people enjoy the country, how do we address that particular issue? The second point is that you seem to be completely discouraging the issue of what we call, I don't think we call it upscale development or something, upmarket development, particularly in some of these beautiful areas of development. What is your problem with this one? Is it environmental concern? Ethical one, or what exactly is your concern about the upscale quality? What's your problem? The second one is when you again discourage from the upscale development, whether in places like former Transkei, those areas have nothing else except the upscale. There's no mines there, no, there are no cities, no manufacturing of any more. The only asset is the land for targeting for foreign and foreign development. Other than that, all they have is their people. Now, what would you view of that? How people can utilize that technology? Then, this issue of the privatization of the beach, where people work with the American end up with a private beach on one way or one side of the other. How prevalent is this situation in South Africa? How much of a challenge is it? Any other comments? I hope that Dr. Malik is ready to give you the other questions.
Thank you. In terms of integrated development along the coastal areas, we certainly would support it. At the moment, we see that much of the development is, as I referred to, upmarket, and we believe that in many instances that's wasteful. We also believe that that also often only caters for a certain small percentage of the population, very small percentage of the population, and denies most of the public access to that section of coastline, and many people are dependent upon those resources for survival. So we have to move towards the more integrated use of our coastal areas. I don't have an actual answer for you in terms of how we're going to go about that. Much of that land is already in private ownership, where one would presumably look at the expropriation. But I do believe that municipalities and state-owned land should be, decisions should be very wisely made in terms of how they use, because that is an opportunity for us to be able to make sure that those that have been denied the privilege of in fact utilizing these beautiful areas are in fact favored in terms of the use that, of the remaining areas that exist. What that means in terms of the law, I don't really know. But at the moment, we're seeing that municipalities are also selling off the crown jewels to rich consortiums of developers, and in many instances, not all the individuals of the consortium are even South Africans.
Who would you think, for me, this would you be opposed to situations where you see a significant percentage of these requirements to be put up by report on the social
development. Yes, I don't have any problem with that. I think that we really do have to resolve this issue. For instance, the area you're talking about around Baluka, and that I know very well, I'm going to comment on that now. But in terms of the West Coast South Africa as well, with regard to a lot of the fishing communities, who since the 60s, through denying of access to the coastline, as well as the removal of the right to utilize the marine resources, the bringing in of quotas, which were gobbled up by 12 huge big fishing companies. Those issues are going to have to be resolved. I think that there's a lot of discussions that can be held around those issues, and I certainly wouldn't like to give you one or two answers, which I think are the only answers. I'm sure that there are many, many answers to that. But just off the top of my head, I was just mentioning that we're supportive of a more integrated use of the coastline. It's a critical resource. It adds huge value to South Africa. And in terms of GDP, it's something like 37% of our GDP. 169 billion it was in 1998, so probably well over 200 billion now. And we all need to share in that. I'm just as disappointed as many other people in terms of the way the coastline is being used now at the moment. Municipalities, as I said, are setting up the crown jewels I can go down that road in terms of how these consortiums are getting hold of the land, so I don't think this is the appropriate place. What I'm saying is that there are maneuvering going on where those consortiums are gaining access to critically beautiful parts of the coastline. And it's happening now. You talk about Kaluka. I can tell you about it because last week I dealt with the issue. There's an appeal that's been submitted because you gave a positive ROD for a development of over 100 houses on that issue. And we have appealed that. But where we'll get to with that appeal, I don't know. But that is it's a beautiful issue. And again, to have just over 100 houses and vehicles in amongst beautiful coastal forests, where each house actually can't see the owners of the next house, is to me not a good use of that resource. And on top of that, there are still not even answers to the sewage plants that they're going to be putting in, and RAF has not been able to give an answer in terms of the availability of water. But a positive ROD was given. So if you really want to unpack what's going on, you need to spend some time with the NGOs, because we can really tell you what is going on, not only just in terms of the coastline, but in terms of South Africa with regards to how the rich are grabbing hold of the resources. And they are not available to by far the majority of South Africa. The issue of how do we address the fact that 90% of the coastline is owned by a very small percentage of people, which is other than the state of land. I don't know what the answer is to that which is already in private hands. All I'm saying is that which belongs to the state and that which belongs to municipalities should be, there must be very careful decision making as to what we do with that land. Very, very careful decision making. And why WESA has an issue about upmarket development, especially golfing estates. We believe that they are extremely wasteful, not only in terms of the land, in terms of the water that they use. They also take up a very small percentage of the population. They drive the price of agricultural land sky high, which is having a huge impact on our ability to be able to generate food in close proximity to coastal towns, because much of our top agricultural land is being taken up for non-agricultural use. And I also have
and I shouldn't be talking as a private individual here, but I also have a great problem with estates that are for the rich, where there's only an occupancy of around about 12% at any one time, and in many instances it's the second or third home. And on top of that, they actually deny access to ordinary people because I believe they just don't want to be having to see that ordinary people are utilizing the same coastline as them. In terms of the previous owners, how to use the substandard, certainly we would welcome an opportunity of being able to enter into discussion, because the previous homelands along the coastline can be utilized, but they need to be utilized sensitively, and I don't believe that the answer is to just hand it over to consortiums that are going to develop it only for the rich. We would support a certain type of development along those previous homelands, which can generate economic opportunities, job opportunities, and so on and so forth. It's not to say that those beautiful areas should not have any development in them whatsoever. It's how you go about developing them to protect the very essence of what makes them so special. They shouldn't be necessarily wrapped in cotton wool and not touched at all. And then privatization of leases, how prevalent? I'm not quite sure how to say how prevalent it is, but I'm saying that you can travel on the coastline for a day or so on the Overberg area or up close in Natal, and especially when you come across upmarket developments, you will see the fences that cover the beaches. And certainly in terms of the managers of the state, they really interfere with people that come across that coastline. Up the west coast, in terms of private farms, there is no access. There are in many instances no access points. So privately owned land runs straight onto fence lines, to fence lines, with no access points. So our prevalent, I don't know, but I would say that up the west coast area probably has been intact for maybe 25-30% of the west coast, and on the more urbanized east coast areas, it's probably related to 5% or so. Which you would have never been had that. Thank you.
The comment of question 8 makes I don't know whether it has been considered by the one position of that. But whatever that has not today, it does worry me because I believe as the countries we respect the approach to also work on the region. And I guess I think the addition that can be made later here is to see whether these people owning these dishes, etc., are not abusing the environment. That's my point to say, if ever they are owning it, but they shouldn't abuse the environment. To me, they say it's so huge,
got first. I think same thing applies here. But I don't know then how that can be sort of played out to put that emphasis. And two, and also to put maybe certain penalties if ever they are acting too big with the environment. That's how I'm looking.
Chairperson, maybe we had to explain, you know, with Monday, but I'm just going to put it by way. I understand the municipalities are playing games with their affluence. And, maybe because of pride and the like, you know, because they seem to be rich. And, in fact, what hurts me most is that they deny access to the ordinary people when they happen to own that land. But I'm just worried because repeatedly, it's being mentioned that there's a game, a dirty game, played by the municipality with their affluence, the rich. Now, I don't know what best can be done, what measures can be taken, just to minimize that threat, if possible. Thank you.
The government doesn't
have to move on the other. Thank you. In terms of the Section 18 access to land and the issue around the local authorities, I believe that the clause that's in the present bill is a critically important one. And I can see that there's a lot of sensitivity around that, where it is stating that local authorities must designate coastal public property, you know, in terms of the land that's under their jurisdiction. And I'm just emphasizing that we support that, but we need to see that it actually does happen. And I think that what we're saying is that clause needs to be emphasized, and the issue of the potential to alienate that land for development purposes must be neutralized somehow or other. Because it is happening, and it's happening all the time, and you can understand the situation where these guys are being approached by consortiums who are prepared to pay an unbelievable fortune for the purchase of certain land areas, and the more beautiful the land is, the more they prepare to pay. And you can see where the cherry, the dangling cherry or carrot, is coming in here, because it's money into the coffers, and it's lots of money into the coffers. But at the same time, you're also alienating the possibility of that land being used in other ways. So we're just saying that we don't believe it's the best way to use the land. It's short-term financial gain for the municipal coffers. And you need to emphasize that the clauses that have been put into the bill will in fact be enacted and as soon as possible, because another 5 years means a huge loss to gain. Then in terms of the honourable members, similar question about the intention of sale of land developers and the denial of access and the dirty game being played by municipalities. I don't know about the dirty game being played by municipalities, but I can say to you that municipalities are in fact selling off their crown jewels to developers, and the developers are paying a lot of money for it. And not only just in terms
know, if the land in the area has a value of, say, 500 rand per hectare, and someone comes along and says, I will offer you 10 to 15,000 rand per hectare, you are obviously going to sell that land. And then that has impact on other agricultural land, and it has that serious impact on poor communities being able to access agricultural land. Because suddenly the price of that agricultural land skyrockets, and no local community can purchase land at that price per hectare. So the upmarket development is also driving the price of agricultural land through the ceiling. Thank you.
and use of natural resources while promoting justifiable economic and social development. Our point is a very simple one, that what has happened is that by contractual act, Transnet being the successor body to the state and still 100% owned by the state, Transnet entered into a contractual arrangement to underpin the selling off of the waterfront. And one of the obligations which it acquired and undertaken in the area of the selection has been to procure the transfer to Lakeshell of such reclaimed land as further becomes available. And the whole development of the waterfront, as members would know, contemplated that there are certain small areas of land, relatively small areas of land, in the perimeter of the current waterfront, and in particularly in the direction of the Granger Bay contemplated fully developed marina. So what will happen there is it's a bit of a physical and a legal conundrum in the sense that if one looks there at the moment, of course one will see nothing. But what would happen in the usual way of land reclamation is that landfill taken from other places, rubble and usually unusable material of that kind, is placed on the seabed. And as a result, in by ordinary principle of law, the seabed in a sort of a sense rises through the water, what is currently occupied by the water. And what has happened, if you look at 11.2, is that no provision is made for the fact that these rights have been acquired, granted by the state effectively through Transnet, and clearly the state would wish to honor. I can't speak for Transnet. Transnet will speak after us, and they will, I would expect, express the view they would wish to see that obligation honored. Not least because the effect of the provision that is read at the moment would be to prohibit the alienation, the transfer, the acquisition of the reclaimed land by Transnet pursuant to its contractual obligation to Lakeshell. Now, first of all, this is the largest single foreign direct investment in South Africa at the moment. Secondly, we've given in our memorandum the scale of the employment and the symbolic importance of the waterfront as being the venue of choice for, I think, 27 million people annually. Thirdly, the scale of the employment. And we make a simple point that if you look at the history of the legislation, you will always find, for example, back in the old Seashore Act, there were no less than two provisions which contemplated the reality that the state had to be excluded to a degree at least from the economic provisions, and that was both through Section 2 and through Section 13B. And there's just been this gap now, and we know now that it is a matter of drafting oversight and that there's no serious intention to expropriate without compensation the rights which have been given by the state. What we have done to try and look at the situation on a minimalistic and simple basis is to draw up what we would table as being an amendment to specify this and to say effectively Section 11 will stand, but under the general arrangement, the transitional arrangement, to have a provision saying that of course vested rights already accrued before the legislation takes effect, nothing after this, no further right of any kind one looking for, but certainly the accrued rights relating to the waterfront back. It really is what it does. If we might just have that one page circulated with your permission, Chair, to those present. So, Chair, that is it in outline. While it's being circulated, could I then just take you, if members haven't had a chance, take you very briefly through the memorandum. I won't trouble with the executive summary, which members would either have read or would do as I'm taking you through matters generally. You will find, set up your convenience, if you turn to page 3 of the document, you will find the history in paragraph 1, the Lakeshell bought the waterfront from Transnet and the pension fund. You will find those figures that I mentioned earlier slightly, perhaps under the influence of the increased petrol price, they inflated the number of people by 1 million. In paragraph 2, we describe the composition of lake shore. Paragraph 3, the mechanism, which we needn't worry about at the moment. And paragraph 4, that in June 2007, the DNA Properties vehicle sold its entire business to lake shore. So lake shore is the owner. In paragraph 5, we give you the reality that there are certain new areas which are expected and avoid being compensated as being reclaimed on the western side of the DNA waterfront, which needs to be dealt with. And then we go on to you under a heading obligations regarding reclaimed land to demonstrate the contractual obligations into which Transnet the state freely entered with the actual effective forebears. And you will see the important one is quoted for you at the top of page 5. This is the contractual obligation. In its capacity as owner of the sea areas outside the breakwater to procure the necessary government approvals for the construction of shore protection works required in connection with the reclamation of all areas constituting the reclaimed land, the seas and capital to its device, and upon completion of reclamation to procure the grant of such land to Transnet and the transfer thereof by Transnet to pension funds. And then comes the 2001 agreement in which Transnet and DNA Properties and Holdings were parties, and you'll see that Transnet undertakes to cooperate to procure the such land, which was the status of state-owned land, is thereafter granted to Transnet as the appropriate authority, having jurisdiction over the water area, and immediately thereafter transferred to DNA Properties. You'll see what it is really is a passing on of that obligation and it's played through to the old seashore pact as regards the genesis of this. And that's what we then go on to deal with in paragraph 8, that under section 2 of the old act, ownership of the seashore and the sea, which is not already alienated. And that again is a clue to you, Chair, because even in 1935 when a new law was made then on the seashore, and I have to say with considerable more simplicity than the definition of coastal land in section 7, but at that time there was a recognition that certain land had already passed. So what one has to do as a lawmaker clearly is to draw a line literally in the sand and to say that we legislate for the position from now on. We can't and we're not seeking to interfere with those rights which are passed. And then under section 18, 8.2, you'll see even then there was a limited carve-out special dispensation for rights or powers conferred upon the administration. The administration effectively ultimately meant SAT, the South African Transport Services, by or under any law related to ports and harbours. And we deal with that meaning of administration in 8.3. We quote for the assistance perhaps of the officials, the provisions with which they that would be familiar, but tracing the two paragraph 8.4, the various steps, which brings ultimately most of the business through Transnet, and that's quoted in paragraph 8.5. That's just to give you the legal nuts and bolts showing that Transnet picked up the responsibility. And you'll see, interestingly, the provision that we quote in section 3.3 of the 1989 Act, top of page 8, the company, that means Transnet, shall become the owner of all movable and immovable provisions. And then the first category is what registered the assets registered. And then to fell under the control or jurisdiction of that. And what that is an interesting phrase, because technically probably right, it wasn't ownership as it was known, but the harbour was managed effectively by a Transnet parent ancestor in the form of that. So they used the language that's under the control or jurisdiction. But now you'll see the purpose of the law in the first sentence we quote on page 8, Transnet became the owner of that. So already, the die was cast, Transnet was already the owner, and for the very good reasons you'll understand that we're talking about a harbour area. We're talking about an area which for a very long time has been the source of vital and huge amounts of transport coming in and out of the country and of the city. No new version of piece of land anywhere. So that takes us through to Transnet, and then we give you a little heading, the present bill, and you'll see that the number of our problem is set out in paragraph 9, where we say that all land which is submerged by the coast of Washington, we're only interested in the reclaimed land. All the land which is reclaimed by the coast of Washington is regarded as coastal public property. This includes the submerged land. In clause 11.1, we point out, as I've done already in paragraph 10, means that the ownership of coastal property without exception lends to the citizen, and 11.2 without exception provides that that coastal public property can't be effectively transferred now by Transnet to Lakeshore. And that's the only reason why we have to say that. Finally, so we can quarrel with the general principle, as a general principle, that we understand the policy behind it, but it can't be intended to undo the major transaction already entered into by the state contractually through the contract of 2001 and 2006. And what we said in paragraph 14, that unless 11 is qualified or trimmed in the way we propose or another way, the difficulty is that effectively the state, we say in the second line of paragraph 14, in the form of Parliament, we're rendering it impossible for itself in the form of Transnet to comply with its existing and vested contractual obligations towards Lakeshore in regard to the reclaimed land. And we say that with a serious implication for the development, the ability to obtain ownership, we say on the top of page 10, of the reclaimed land was an essential driver of the transaction. And we don't mention it here, but the officials may find it consistent to look at the Supreme Court of Appeal decision in 2005, I think volume 3 of the South African Law Report, in the litigation between the South African Forestry Corporation and York Corp. And what had happened was interesting, because Capco, like Transnet, was a child of the state. It was, if you like, a corporatized part of a former Department of Ministry of Forestry, and it was sued by York Corp to provide logs. It had an earlier contractual obligation to provide these, and it tried to put up the answer that there was new legislation which was cutting across this, and that this constitutes supervening impossibility of performance, which meant that the South African state government could walk away from the obligation. And the unanimous court said, no, you can't create your own impossibility. You can't pass a law, as it were, which would cut across an accruing or vested right. You can't then get out of the trouble that you'd be under in certain section 16 of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, which is you cannot have a taking of property which is not, first of all, for a proper purpose, which is not arbitrary as it would be if it's simply an undoing of what you've already promised to do, and thirdly, which is without compensation. And of course, in this case, we're not only talking about the $7.5 billion purchase price, but we're talking about the enormous consequential claims which would arise regarding the lost opportunities, the loss of future generation of business for the BEE International Consortium. So we say clearly it's an oversight which requires this, a minor piece of surgery, and we suggest that we say here on the heading proposed remedy, something to the effect, and I'll show you the wording we suggest, that nothing will conclude Transnet for honouring this already accrued obligation. I can say that it's not some kind of freeway for Transnet to go around and incur new obligations. We're dealing only with the prompt, only with an accrued obligation, and it is to that extent that a very limited, cognizable exception. If I might ask you, against that background, to pick up the single piece of paper which has been circulated, and if I could show that to you, Chair, you will see that we suggest that it be accommodated in section, as a section 95A, under the general provision, I think it's chapter 12, isn't it? The transitional, it's under a heading of general, and then it's transitional. But that's a matter of detail. It could also be done in section 11. The wording we're proposing is this. First of all, the heading you'll see is specifically related to and limited to the V&A waterfront, and it will be along the lines of notwithstanding sub 1 and 2 of 11, Transnet Limited or any successor entitled, if I could just explain that, Transnet itself, as I said, is already itself a child of tax, and the nature of things at some later stage, there may be a hiding off or a dividing or something of Transnet, as it happened in certain respects, so we put it in the succession cycle, may comply with any contractual obligations incurred, Transnet, by it to any party prior to the commencement of the act in relation relation to the reclamation of land. So you'll see how narrow it is. It's only class debt or successor. It's only in relation to contractual obligations already incurred by it to any party prior to the commencement of this act. Further strict limitation doesn't speak to the future. And most importantly, it's only in relation to the reclamation of the land after a date of the ceremony in particular made. And then you refer to the reclaiming according to reclaim those portions of seashore as our village to be reclaimed and specified the agreement. And we say that to make clear that it won't be at least a transient vesting in the city of the public, but it won't vest in the city. Secondly, Transnet may procure the granting of such reclaimed land to itself. And thirdly, C, transfer title in the reclaimed and granted land to any party. Again, probably the matter of drafting, it might be a good idea after party to insert the semicolon and then drop that last phrase pursuant to accept contractual obligation underneath C. So it's frankly it's redundant because the first dominant clause is this comes from the contract. The first clause you'll see refers to may comply with any contractual obligation. But everyone's going to have it in. I think it's right that probably one should make it very clear that that phrase, pursuant to the contractual obligations, a closing of the provision applies to A, B, and C, and makes it very clear that this is no Magna Carta for anything in the future. It's purely for a past accrued contractual dealing as regards to the right to have a vesting. Yes. And of course, you would be aware of the fact that as regards the reclamation, there is no attempt here to seek any exemption or exoneration from the full protection of all environmental checks which would operate around the reclamation process itself. They have to be EIAs, all that kind of thing. There's no exclusion of the operation of a single other statutory provision. All this is saying is that Clause 11 doesn't mean that South Africa, through Transnet, can't honour the obligation that it's approved. We draw finally in that article MB that you will see there are one or two little consequential cross references that will have to go into section 65.1 and 65.2, but those are that's matter of nitpicking drafting just for your attention. So, Chair, that is the proposal. If there's any aspects in which we can answer or assist with clarification, we would obviously be glad.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I find myself at a distinct disadvantage because I'm, first of all, facing the Honourable Gauntlet and the reputation process is anything possible. Particularly the legal fraternity.
On a point of correction, unfortunately not Honourable Issues.
Firstly, Chair, I'm sure President Gauntlet will appreciate the fact that I don't think kindly to be implied by ambush because I've had time to read the papers or give a contrary response. But on a cursory response to some of the issues that were raised, I think a lot of the things that are being asked for me are quite drastic, and we need to give some serious consideration to all the implications before we can give them off the cuff responses. There are some serious legal issues that have been raised. There's case law that is titled that we would like to move those and explore. But there are some issues that I would, however, like to lay before the committee before we engage on the legal issues, which I presume would not be able to completely done today. One of them is that there's a reference to the accrued obligations incurred between Transnet and Letshop. And to me, there's almost the impression that it's based on the supposition or it's presupposing that the environmental impact assessment will actually be positive. Because I hear that there will be that there's a full commitment to undergo all the other environmental assessments and and all the rest of the legal requirements. That raises the question that the bill is not the only possible impediment to the performance of the contractual obligation, but there may in fact be other impediments in the way of the actual EIA process, because if that regulation does not meet the environmental requirements of the EIA, that in itself is going to impact on the accrued obligation and potential right. I'm not quite sure that I agree that there is an approved right here. It seems to me that there's an undertaking by Transnet to assist in terms of a few of certain things. But certainly, I'm of the view, and I'm sad to correct you, that Transnet certainly doesn't have the authority to grant an EIA or to enforce an EIA. So in the absence of an EIA, one can't assume that this is an open and shut case. That is the one issue. The other issue is that I think it's quite remarkable that we are being asked, for me, well, for the first time in my experience, to make a singular exception in a piece of legislation. I'm not saying that it's impossible, I just think that it is really an obvious risk. I've never seen it in any other law before. That's also probably because I'm not that old, but I'm sure my learned colleague will point out certain exceptions. I do think that we would have to be convinced that there is a really good case to make a singular exception in a piece of legislation of general application, because I think that there may be problems with that, and I think that may set a precedent that's going to open us up to problems that we do not anticipate if we too easily access to a specific legislation. I do request the indulgence to actually give proper consideration to all the representations made by access to the board list so that we can have an informed response and consideration of all the issues at hand.
Thank you, Chair. Just a point of clarification, really. What I understand, and I'm not going to sort of build on to what Advocate Rodrigo already said, so this is only for the V&A waterfront and only for a small area of the Cape Town port. It's also been brought to my attention that in fact there is a proposal on the table for a 3 km by 3 km island to be built between Cape Town and Robben Island. Now I'm not sure if we're going to get a similar request for that. And then just to also point out, of course, the boundaries of the Cape Town port in fact goes all the way from the Green Point Lighthouse to Robben Island and to Mount Port Strand. So we're looking at an area of roughly 22 kilometers of coastal water, the coastline, which is nearly 100 square kilometers, which actually belongs to the port. If you look at all the ports, we are actually looking at in excess of 200 kilometers of coastline that we're talking about here. And we're looking at nearly 1,000 square kilometers that have been sort of reserved for ports. I'm just wondering, are we going to get similar requests from other areas? And so, yeah, in short, I don't think it was a draft. You know, we're fully aware of the problem. But, yeah, certainly we will consider it. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much,
Chair, and I think this is probably a very dumb question. But I just wonder, when the deal was done, were there no qualms on the part of Transnet and Eggshell that they were parting with state land to a private investor?
Okay, thank you, Chair. Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite a complex issue, as all of these issues are. What I do want to know, though, is firstly, you know, this is a transaction that's taken place between Transnet and Eggshell, but is there other areas in the country where similar situations have arisen as well? I mean, is there other areas which Transnet owns as such, and where suddenly now, with the introduction of the bill, those ownership rights change? Because essentially what I see happening here is that a contract was entered into with belief that certain ownership rights existed with Transnet, which probably did at that time, but with this bill coming into effect will not exist. Does this affect any other companies, or does this affect any other areas in South Africa where such a thing happens? I mean, I understand this is a contractual, they're speaking specifically to this contractual arrangement, but I also think, to be fair, we need to look at what other areas are affected, even where such a contractual obligation hasn't been entered into. I mean, I'd be interested to hear how ownership rights change around the country in terms of the introduction of this bill. Thank you.
Yes, just some clarity on it's referred to as reclaimed land. Could you define that in what sense was it land that was once above water level?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you can explain that for context of what reclaimed land in this situation means. The advocates on this side have said that that this potentially refers to a massive area of land. I think from their side, you are painting this idea of an island right up to the other side of Robben Island. I think that's not what you're saying, and if you could clarify that. And then from the advocate point of view, I'm not sure how the issue of EIA at the end of the day has got anything to do with this particular piece of legislation. If I own a piece of property or have rights to a piece of property, I'm always subject to EIA in the future. So, from what I understand from the advocates on this side, is that this is merely an attempt to exercise rights, but they're admitting that they are restricted anyway by any provisions of EIAs and the processes that they have to go through. So I'm not at all sure how that is relevant, because if NCM is worried, and from what I see the way it's being phrased on this side, is that it's a concern about a certain type of development that is already in the air, and they want to prevent that. There are presumably many other ways to prevent it than denying someone the right to exercise a right that has been ceded them by a particular contractual agreement between two parties.
Okay, if I'm sorry, just for clarity, so I don't lose the points, I'm going to take them in the same order, even if that's a little untidy with your permission. First of all, Chair, I'd hate your members to think that we are some sort of pinstripe ambush. We did, as you might know, adopt the precaution of sending to our full memorandum last Thursday. And I'm just both to Parliament and to the Ministry. I'm just very sorry if somehow or the other that's not good enough, because short of nailing it to some door somebody must tell me about, it's very hard for people like us to engage if we can't go to the two obvious institutions. First of all, Parliament, privacy, I would have thought, on Thursday, and privacy, I would have thought, to the Ministry. And if there's an internal failure somewhere, then certainly the description of the ambush needs to be qualified and trend. The main point raised by Advocate Rodrack in her response was that we were before you presupposing that an EIA would be positive. In fact, the last speaker put the position, I would suggest, utterly correctly, and it is this. So that what we're trying to do is a narrow thing purely related to the fact that our contractual rights are about to be submerged under the waters of this legislation if adopted in its current form. Purely that. But if anybody buys a piece of land, you will not find some nannying provision in there which says, do remember to pay VAT or to comply with the Income Tax Act, or do remember that you too are under the law and are bound by other environmental legislation. Legislation doesn't do that. It deals like a car going down the road, would it stop it? Feels that that is fully, not more fully, but as fully as it believes it should be. So as a matter of a legal proposition, and I have to say common sense, it could never be that a provision dealing with the ownership aspect and nothing more would claim any right to somehow shrug off the full weight of the environmental provision. So the late speakers very correctly summarized the position in that regard. Secondly, the major point raised was a question, a doubt, about whether there had been a vesting of accrued rights. That certainly would be a matter which would have to receive a very serious consideration in this matter, because if a position were to be adopted, the Parliament were to be adopted to the state, were to be advised, the state law advisors, so that what happened in 2001 and 2006 with the solemn contracting of Transnet on behalf of the state, and I'll come to the Crown question in a moment on that, but what happened then accorded no rights which existed prior to the adoption of this legislation, then it's going to be a very serious difficult situation. It's certainly not right. What happened when Transnet, in language which is very familiar to those working with contracts, undertook to procure certain rights? What is it saying to somebody, like I say to somebody, I undertake to procure for you my brother-in-law's car. I'm picking up a contractual obligation, which on the moment the contract vests in that purchaser. And effectively what I'm doing is I'm saying, I'm telling you something which I don't have yet. But people do that all the time. People, as their members know in relation to property transactions, will say, I undertake to procure the approval of a local authority to a particular measure, or I undertake to procure the bottom field, whatever the provision may be. If the person who undertakes and whose undertaking is accepted in the contract, thereafter turns around and shrugs and says, well, let me sit up and procure, it wouldn't give you much of a right, would it? Anybody who's answered that position would be laughed out of the lower court. It's just not contract law 101. The next point is, which was raised as a potential objection, really related to a matter of form, and that is the question of this being a single exception. Advocate Rosbeck is right. It's a rare instance indeed, but you will find instances, and you find a forebear even in 1935 Act where there is an exclusion related to the administration. Now, there you've got one. Here's the administration. Now you have an instance here where there is a transfer which is a piece of legislation which would make a singular exception related to a singular development. You'll find other things if you go and look at Kempton Park and even in Johannesburg in relation to this and the legislation concerning O.R. Tambo Airport. If you've got a big thing, and it's on your doorstep, you've got to deal with the big thing. Otherwise, the elephant in the room, which everybody pretends isn't there. The third aspect which sets it apart is that this concerns the state. It concerns the state acting through its wholly owned entity set up under the Succession Act, and to which under Section 3.1 of the Succession Act, what is called its commercial enterprise was transferred. So there are no good reasons why it would be, with respect to inconsequential matter of form, that they were too uncomfortable about reference to a particular instance. As regards the question of the qualms, Transnet will speak for its own qualms or lack of qualms if it's required, but I would have thought that the answer is this, that we know in the situation post-1993, partly because of the bloated state of the state, particularly, colleagues and members would know regarding, for example, the defense institution, there are huge areas of South Africa which are unnecessarily and many think wastefully owned or vested in the state. So particularly when the Department of Defense in the pre-1993 era made it its business to acquire vast areas of land, sometimes for what you might have thought at the time, a necessary purposes, sometimes a wholly improper purposes regarding shooting preserves and the like. And I've been involved in instances regarding those. The short point is that after 1990 to all three, there's been an attempt to look at what the state really needs. And what was determined was that there's a whole change of members know regarding the water crunch, which used to be a smelly, active, hardcore port. And thanks to people with commercial long-term vision, the decision arose, why do we have this huge facility full of derricks and oil tanks from which the public is largely excluded? It's the most beautiful part of the city. It's the gateway, the sea gateway to the city. It's truly repellent, truly unnecessary, and it's not part of the democratic spirit not to develop it for something that people have access to. So I would hope that the only qualm that there would have been for those who want to keep to it. And what the state would have to decide is whether we are in the business of running tourism, of whether we can find the resources, whether we can develop it, whether we're interested in running safe houses and places where our children can go, where they are able to attend out-of-door performances as they are, the various facilities there. And it was decided no, the state's not in that business, and that policy decision was taken. So I would suggest that it would be an ahistorical and unfortunate approach to say that one must cling on to all land. I would hope that in fact the attitude would be to look at what is the right balance, how could it be best developed, and of course, at the same time, subject to the environmental concerns which the bill is intended to bring to bear. As regards the question of other areas, where it's not ready for us to speak about that. We are the only people who have put up our hand in relation to that. But that gave rise also to a concern which has been articulated, that we were a sort of a tip of an iceberg, and that we might literally surface with a claim for a 3-kilometer island or Robben Island. You'll notice again, if one reads the draft carefully, this is very narrow. It's only the reclamation of land at or adjacent to the Victorian or Alfred waterfront, and then it's defined in the agreement. We have the plan, and the plan can be shown, but there are three portions of land, which are specified on the plan as contemplated. So the short point is, if somebody tries to come in on our coattails otherwise and says they want to have a floating funfair of Robben Island or some sort of huge other island, the answer will be, well, where we can't. Read clause 11. No one in South Africa may do that. No one in South Africa may lay claim to that as a matter of ownership. Whether there are other means with the permission of the state to revisit in a way that could be achieved would have to be considered. I don't have a place to speak myself. But the short point is, this is the tiniest but bespoke bikini we've been able to devise for the problem. It has no ambition to provide anything wider than honouring an obligation. Now, I would say, in the end, the ultimate question is going to be that if and when the memorandum that we submitted on Thursday is studied and is analysed, the consideration has to be, the position has to be adopted, whether it's accepted that these are rights which are approved, that under the dispensation which was intended at the time, intended to be honored, and it's not your intention, the legislature, to take away with the right hand what was given on by the left hand for those purposes. Now, later, we would be very happy if there was any assistance to our colleagues that would like to meet with us to clarify this. It's unfortunate that it hasn't happened between Thursday and now, but we would obviously wish to cooperate as fully as we could to highlight that and to answer any residual questions which they or others may have in the legal process. But we would ask members, in conclusion, really then to accept three main propositions, or to ponder on three main propositions. One is the fact that effectively the left hand of the state has lawfully given, and the question then is whether it is intended by legislation to undo it. Secondly, if it is intended to undo it, consideration would have to be given the very serious consequences of an intended undoing. And thirdly, the focus would have to be on the narrowness of what is put up and on the full acceptance, as has been highlighted equally in the discussion today, that whatever other constraints operate on this development, whether through this or other, well, through environmental legislation, EIAs, through the tax authorities, or anything else, the law applies to us. We're all under the law. We're particularly under the law. You don't have to make an environmental, piece of environmental legislation, which spells out the fact that we have to pay tax and we have to get EIAs and the like. That's the extent. We propose nothing. If in the course of reclamation, it's prohibited because it's unhealthy or unsafe or something of that kind, well then that's it. But what one can't do with great respect, there seems to be something alerting purchases, is to concentrate undue contractual obligation by applying purposes confined, conferred for other purposes, namely the environmental. It's the rights have been given. That was a decision which was taken and passed legal scrutiny. The only question now is, as regards the environmental bill, whether it is intended to maintain what needs to suggest it is an unintentionally wide form. And in answer to the point which was put to me about it having been consecrated, what may have been consecrated is not wanting to have the wider harbour being developed. But what has unfortunately been lost in the thought is three things. One is the definition of Cape Town Harbour is at the moment, unfortunately, a legitimate embarrassment because it includes up the wall of the castle, it includes the convention centre, it includes all the hotels, and I understand that is being looked at. But secondly, a reading of what we put up in our memorandum and specified in the bill, we confined ourselves to those portions which are referred to in the contract that is only reclaimed. Lastly, I did forget to answer the question regarding the reclamation. I'm no engineer, but I understand really the combination of physics and legal position is this. If you imagine in your mind's eye the end of the current waterfront, where the door also are, etc., beyond, say, the breakwater, you have a situation where the breakwater itself is a historical reclamation and the like. What happens is there is currently sea as defined. There is under the sea shore, seabed. What happens is that landfill is brought, it is dropped into the sea where it is approved, appropriate, it's dropped, it rests on the seabed. You then have the legal conundrum that in South African common law, ownership, as it were, rises up. You have the situation that artificially, if you like, the seabed has risen up. And that's what we're dealing with. It's not sucking away the sea. It's just going to be, in a limited respect, provided for, and which will be available to be looked at, and which, as I keep stressing, would be subject to the full panoply of environmental control. As are the other activities, have the other activities of Transnet that historically been in the harbour. Transnet can't act like Genghis Khan. It has to operate under the control of the law. We effectively sit as Transnet successors in relation to that, and we too will be under the net. Thank you, Chair. I don't know if there's anything else we can do.
Now, it's the Mokka and the Mokka. against them. I don't know that members against students this satisfactory, but this is the waterfront at the moment. What is already being reclaimed is this A, large A area here. And that goes back to the times, the breakwater prisons, and after that. It's the whole building on from the edge of the wall here. It's happened historically. Then you've got these areas. These are the areas that are specified in the agreement to which I've referred. There's the elbow at F, and there's the Granger Bay Marina at B. Those are the areas which we've outlined in orange. I must stress that one of them, I think it's B, is the one which is subject to, yes, that's the Granger Bay one, which is subject to still some debate and shifting. And you'll find that in our submission, yes, it's specified in the contract, which I've already drawn attention to and in our submission. So that's what we're talking about. No Robben Island, not out beyond that. But that's the
answer. So, if I may follow up on that question, I've seen three different areas that you pointed out. Have you paid for all three portions that you're talking about, or you paid for a specific portion?
We paid for the entirety. We said in our submissions, if you find it, you'll see that we specified this in paragraph 14. At the topic page 10, we've said there that the development rights for which we paid the 7.5 billion rand were a major factor in fighting the present investors to bid for the VA waterfront. The ability to obtain ownership of the reclaimed land developed as the essential driver of the transaction. So yes, it's part of the sale. It's being bought. The only question which was raised, you may recall, was the obligation about procurement, which I dealt with earlier, and in relation to which Transnet is procuring. Yes, and you'll find also in paragraph 7, the actual Transnet undertaking, that the where we talked about undertakes to cooperate to procure that such land is thereafter granted to Transnet and immediately thereafter transferred to DNA properties for no further consideration to DNA properties. So nothing more will be paid, it's already been paid for.
One assumes that Fletcher is quite a big player. One of the biggest investments in South Africa. Would you have been aware of this intended? Because it's leading at least the last year. Well, have you had any direction with the Department of Office?
Chair, there have been interactions, I understand. I haven't been personally party to them. The difficulty is that the matter then has passed into your hands, and I understand immediately there's obviously institutional respect for Parliament that we can't, as it were, cut across that. Our problem was that we became aware of it, as it were, when it was part of the legislative process. What I think will be confirmed for you by the ministry representatives is that what is currently on is not as if we've had a debate and a controversy. You've heard the indication has been that this matter hasn't yet been fully examined, as it were, from a legal viewpoint. So that's where we are. It's not as if we hear saying we had loggerheads and please would you be the tiebreaker. We hear because it got into your hands faster than we knew, and so we've had to come to you and address you institutionally as the body we have to deal with in the first instance, but of course also our colleagues would be involved in how to make it better if that is their view.
Is there any other questions?
Stefan, I was still looking, I'll just have a question going to the question. With regard to any excellent submission of this proposition, the fact that there was a message between the United States and also the consequences of what should be, and then he narrowness, the insularity of the city. Yeah. And it would have quickly affected some of the countries to have Russian reserves. Number three, OPEC. Now that the EU should have received 1% of the reserves.
Surely, first of all, left-hand, right-hand. By that I meant that, first of all, you're not concentrating some private transaction where somebody's up there complaining, as I said, my little CCC example, complaining about that. We have here a conscious, post-democratic decision by the state that is not in the business of selling cheeseburgers and entertaining tourists. It sees a magnificent area of land which for too long has been wasted. Those of you who may have visited the Zico National Art Gallery would know there's a very famous and beautiful painting, 19th century painting of Cape Town, which had as a vision for the city a flow from the mountain right down to the sea. And as you know, sadly, what happened to the development of the port is the people were cut off, and what should have been and once was a very beautiful piece of shoreline was substantially damaged. What happened is that the state has decided we're not interested in that. We not only have no qualms about getting rid of it, we think it's in the public interest to do so. And I don't think I answered your question earlier about the public interest.
Yeah,
question.
Transnet has a deficit in its pension fund. And it has gone to other means that the first such more money must be taken from the tax, a lot of people depending on who rely on this pension fund. People have worked for many years and people have done full time today, so that those pension contributions will not be honored by the hospital generation. So if you have a right fund, what you do now is to make this fund available. What else?
I'm sure that was the sort of thinking about public interest which took place at the time. Shortly put, we know what it was like, those of us who are old enough, that there were only railway workers and members of the second oldest profession who frequented the docks. And what happened was that there'd be a vision of a wonderful use which, as you say, also had certain economic implications. That is what happened. I may say where you sit now is something that the chair indicated earlier, as I said in a question put to Mr. Gubb, that you will always be mindful of the constitutional mandate through section 24, which talks about reasonable legislative and other measures, which inter alia secure ecologically sustainable development and use of natural resources while promoting justifiable economic and social development. And we know how hard that is. We know how hard it is with certain areas that you want them to be beautiful. So the best way of keeping them completely beautiful is to fence them all from all human beings. Can't be done. That's the dilemma. I know that you have far more experience than I. But that is the aspect of the public good. Just reverting, what I was saying, left-hand gave, both constitution, gave contractually, and undertook to procure the transfer of the land, thereby undertook an exigible and enforceable obligation to do that. That's the first aspect which raises itself. The second question I ask, against that background, what this body would have to ask is not whether you think it's a bad contract or a good contract, but whether you are consciously taking a legislative decision which disregards its existence. And we would submit that that's not your intention, as little as it would be your intention to simply say that nobody may own seashore in such terms that you have the finance club, the lady banging on your door and saying, well, what about us? And you've made provision for them, as we read Clause 7. The provision hasn't been made for us. And all we're saying is that we've got to be consistent about some of these things. If I had my own way as a lover of finance club, I would never have allowed that harbor to be built there. So it's there, it's happened. It's like Tower Bridge on the Thames. There's some things which are there, and you can't undo that portion of history. We have a portion of history here which is not one to be ashamed of, and it's pleasant to have to deal with a situation like that. We have the state trying to turn itself from this bloat behemoth, owning too much land, keeping the public out of it, making a go of it. We have a situation now where 26 million human beings a year go there, and 26 million human beings can't be wrong. And what happens after that is we say that that diet card, those rights have been accorded. All that remains is for Transnet to be permitted to do that which it would have done, could have done, and undertook now to do. But as I've said so many times, it's not here seeking some sort of exoneration from the general law of South Africa. All it wants is to be exonerated or to be excluded from the operation in the width of clause 11.2. It will still be hit by everything from VAT to EIS. Those are the thoughts. And yes, the third point, I'm reminded, thank you, by Mr. Poe. The third point I made was, I think, implicitly what I've said. Now, as you can read what we put up, we're not asking here for some sort of exemption, exclusion of the whole harbour as defined, the 100 square kilometres you were told to make your fresh creek. We're talking about these areas designated for reclamation in immediate proximity of the waterfront, and which are specified in the contractual arrangement exactly. I show you the plan, I told you the one portion may change a little bit as a result of engineers' intervention, but it's specified, and our colleagues can be given that and be shown the exact. They've been given it already. They've got it already. So it's there. It's accessible. Thank you, Chair.
Anyone want to advocate the contract? I think it's clear in terms of the essence that most of the mission is that we're able to discuss this in some more detail and look at it. You can consider mechanism issues, etc. So I hope that we will be directing with the department to take up from this. For me, I think part of what we would have to not be seen would be a situation where this legislation does not move away from its general provision. But that general provision assert that they can address your concern. Without that, I would be a little bit awkward about telling the specific amendment that might that involve the waterfront. I'm not a legal fool. I would think that we should ensure that our legislation has got general applicability. Whatever transaction that we send that in, the legal transaction, which under the, I mean, it's in the context of the rule of law. So, whatever we do should be able to accommodate that. I would not be comfortable with I'm not saying that we will not do it if we are convinced that we should do it. But I would hope that the present scope of the decision is able to accompany it. But the general, not the human, that the exceptionalized is whatever.
Yes, Chair, I might just very briefly respond. What we're trying to do is not make it more difficult. We could have come and suggested that what you should be recognizing are generally accrued and vested rights. We're not doing that because it may be that there is a legitimate constitutional concern, for example, that instances I acted for the Eastern Cape government against those coastal fishing shack owners who allegedly bought land with bottles of white horse from local leaders. And it's a huge, we know, environmental concern about which Mr. Gubb, I'm sure, will tell us a great deal. The point about it is this: if you go for the general, you'll have to think very carefully how you don't then suck back into that kind of exclusion for any accrued rights, people in that category. And I would think you don't. Secondly, the state is the state is the state. The state is not some whiskey dispensing shack owner. And if the state through Transnet has acted in the way that it did, it's a very particular kind of exception. It's a common one. Thirdly, you will find proof of that, precedent for that, in exactly what happened in the Seashore Act. The common law of South Africa, going back to Holland, is that the land vests in the res publica, in the state. In 1935, they gave that to the Governor General, and after, of course, became the state president. But obviously not for his personal royal preserve, it was for the people. That's complicated. But even then there was a realization. I had it in front of me. You read section 13b, there was a saving provision. So nothing contained in this act shall affect any rights or powers conferred upon the administration by or under any law relating to ports and harbors. Then the next mechanism is to say that the administration is controlling the harbors. And then in 1989, when Transnet was set up, partly because South Africa was starting to move towards de-bloating itself and trying to get itself out of the cheeseburger business, it didn't want to be letting wharves and dockyards and that in a non-commercial way. It needed to make money for the reasons which the honourable member has identified. What happened then, they said, that control or supervision, it's in our memorandum, that we deem to be ownership. But all this has happened, and sometimes you cannot unscramble an egg. It's not a tainted apartheid egg. It's a public property problem egg. And it was going in the way that the democratic society is reinforced. Namely, we've got to do what we've got to do for the people. But we're not in the business of selling cheeseburgers and showing tourists around. So all that happened, and what we're saying cumulatively is that the critical decision for this committee would be whether it is legislatively appropriate, and I have to say safe, to adopt a provision which rides a bus through the contractual obligations the state picked up. If the answer is that it is not, then the question is how does one deal with it? And one can not mention the W word, the waterfront word. One can say subject to then what? You can then try and say subject to such other rights as may have vested in the state and as may have been disposed of in some means or the other by the state. Well, one can do that, provide a provision. But what we're trying to do is, you appreciate, we have for a narrow mandate. We can find, and I'm sure our colleagues can find wider words if the narrower ones are not attractive. But we would submit the big issue of principle is that the right hand of the state intend to undo what the left hand of the state has done, aware of the difficult consequences of it. Thank you very much, sir, for your patience.
Anyone wants?
Thank you, Chair. I'm Peter Bow from Transnet. Chair, I think my presentation or my interest can be very, very short. grant is basically, the background given by the grant is basically supports that. And I think we can just re-emphasize the point that has been belabored up to this stage. That what we're dealing with, and I think the placing of it in the bill is very important, is a visual arrangement to complete a picture that has already begun to be drawn, and according to law, certain consequences to be done for it. It's not an exception. I think what is being placed before this committee is a request to acknowledge the reality of a certain set of facts that is inherited, and to craft a transitional arrangement that caters for that specific, very narrowly, but with a huge impact situation that has come about. In the presentation that I'm not going to read to you, in the written submission that was submitted to you, as chairperson of this committee, we've also proposed some options on drafting. Chairperson, they neither here nor there. The bottom line is that these are proposals to address the transitional arrangement, to complete something that context could lawfully do at the stage, and which is now going to be changed to some extent by the new legislation, by the provisions of the bill. I think that is what the essence is. What the different drafting options basically entail is just a mechanism to complete the actions required. And it's then a matter of style and preference and things like that, that one can debate even offline with the technical drafters in that regard. So with that, I would propose to get my input. Thank you.
I will also advocate power.
Yes, Jeff, and I'm also interested in Dr. Byron. No, it's not too much.
Thank you, Leonard, advocate power. Oleg Wallet.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask a question to Transnet. What actually motivated Transnet to actually sell this piece of property under a deal of having a transferring a freehold title deed rather than a long-term lease agreement?
Really difficult to engage with the lawyer if people have the fingers and the law. But to me, really, I need an explanation. Maybe most of them are not the lawyer. But I hear the partner talk about the arrangement that we can look at. And the previous presentation was talking about the actual exemption. To me, I think the same language, just that the different ways, one is arrangement, one is exception. I need someone maybe from the guru, from the law, to explain that to me. I think that is the same language. I left one from the other way.
Say the exception took place, the law was passed with that inclusion. Once the ownership of the land, once the land is owned by Leksha, would there be any way of confining it to the development that was part of the original, of what we saw in the original plan, or would one's ownership that taken place with the other developments and more, even though the EIA would have to be passed, they would be very careful to remain within the whole confines of the EIA. But what happens then? I mean, developers have a way of expanding on their development.
item. I'm referring to the same as a carbon instrument here. Of the top of one. And that means, just like the case of the CNC, of the AMO, we have to have a contaminant with a control committee, the first time of the public at the time, of the CNC. I'm just suggesting that we should have a joint consultant with our counterpart, or partner of the site. So as to remove any of the what appears obvious investment, basically, so our customers can also be empowered, because we are coming from an environmental point of view, but they're the ones who actually see the responsibility of this content. So we don't want to take the case now, and I'm sure for the agency to say, because there's a real community here, and that's what we're going to do. And of course, we hope the exercise over time. Now we are coming in late in the day when what has really gone under the bridge. But the only problem is that now the environmental impact has been to become special. So I think what I think should do is that the farmer should be there as well until the issue is myself coming in the bridge. And then take confidence from the input and then unlikely then to check the report. But then that day, if you are just trying to
I disagree with you, with Honourable McQuena. I mean, I don't see really the difference, the similarities between this and the NEMA bill. I mean, I think we're dealing here, there are certain issues on the table, and as difficult as they may seem as legislators, because I know legislators, you always get nervous when the word exception is raised. But we're dealing with an issue of law and contract. So from where we are at the moment, Chairman, I would suspect that the logical thing to do is to give the law advisors and the Marine Coastal Management the full chance to respond from their point of view. To add to that as well, not only responding to the particular submission, and I don't blame that gentleman who brought here, but they've got a particular interest. There are other people who must have dropped the ball in this, and there could be many others. So, I mean, I would be interested, Chair, if the department could come back with a response, particularly to the exclusion for transitional arrangements. And secondly, to look as well at, in fact, the implications of what has been raised here, because it may be the case that there are other, particularly an electric state entity that have entered into contractual obligations, which are affected by this particular piece of legislation. And perhaps there is scope and a necessity, in fact, for a more broader exclusion to be included, and not the narrow exclusion, but that's what I don't blame the gentleman for bringing in our exclusion. They have a particular interest that it would be directed against others. And so, in summary then, I don't find, although it's complex, I don't find it as messy as the other issue with two departments effectively fighting for political control right to provide environmental authorization. Here, we are, as we just say, looking for someone to help us navigate through a particular type of law and its implications of whether, in fact, we make one decision or another, what the repercussions are for Parliament and the people's legislation.
So very briefly, just because it's tangentially something that's been raised to respect, which we do need to, which we may say something on very shortly. I understand the disquiet and disinclination of any lawmaking body to be faced with a hand that goes up to pick and pay or to deals or somebody and says, yes, but not me. That, you can't make laws that way, because the Constitution requires one to make laws of general application. The problem, however, is this, is whether you meet up when you use very wide words. For example, it often happens in the preliminary drafting of statutes that somebody may use an inexact wide word like livestock. And the critical question, if somebody comes along and says, you know, livestock, if you go to the OED document in the English dictionary, which is not only cattle, sheep, but goats. Are you seriously intending to include in this bill the risk of self-goat population? If the answer is yes, then you must do it. But if the answer is no, thank you for highlighting that. But you're not accepting, excluding, giving some sort of Christmas box to the risk of self. What you're saying is, that, hang on, we don't intend to include goats. This is intended largely for commercial cattle or sheep farming, whatever the point is. It all lies in the choice of the word. Our difficulty, in a nutshell, is when you use the word coastal public property, or when you use, you haven't used it yet, but in contemplation, coastal public property, in clause 11, at the moment, as defined, we tumble into it, here by virtue of the question of the land to be claimed. Because that has not yet, that land has not yet been transferred, so it is not excluded. If you want to use the E-word, it's there, in your own draft, if you look at clause 70, you've got exclusion. You've got to have exclusion. Otherwise, you're going to sweep up the Cybertown dockyard. So the critical thing is how one finds the right language, which makes sure that the opportunists who want to save their whiskey purchase, the CCC fishing has the enders, they don't come along and find some sort of gap. You don't want that, you want to preserve the environment. But you can't, as much as you might want to, but as much as I might want to, wish away Salisbury Island or Simonstown Dockyard, those things are bought, are built, already done. So, the point then is really lies in the ambit of it. And if you don't mean livestock, all we're saying is please don't say livestock. They're not asking you to say livestock, comma, excluding the farm owned by Pete Young 20 kilometers outside Beaufort West. That's an exclusion. That you would not be able to suggest what to do. The last point, if I may, in relation to Transnet, I think it would be very helpful to you if it could just be clarified on behalf of Transnet whether, in fact, Transnet supports the draft that we table so that we know that you're not confronted with, as it were,
quality. I'm supposed to be afraid that this chair is probably going to be done. Thank you, Chair. Yes, we support their draft because it covers exactly what we intend to cover in the region of the public, not perhaps in such a good manner. So we support the team. Okay, but then I think then also the suggestion moves is that it's necessary then for the department to have a look at it so that so we can then raise the issues at the basis of the Act on that basis. Because I think a good presentation has been made here, and the request to ask for more information or consideration time to look at it, I think that would be the opportunity. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Are there any other
comments?
Chair, I had actually asked a question out of curiosity, and it has not been answered, and it was directed to Transnet.
Okay.
Chairperson, yeah, that was the question regarding the cell. I think to answer that, we have to go back to the history, and that is why I think the presentation by the Gauntlet actually put that out. It is not as if Transnet decided one day we're going to sell something to an external private person. The issue was that certain assets were transferred to the Transnet Pension Fund for them to manage the best interest of the pension fund beneficiaries. And it is those assets that have now ultimately been contracted and transferred the rights containing these to Lexel. So it's part of the whole history where the Transnet Pension Fund also dealt with part of its assets to generate pension benefits for its members. Transnet had to be a constant party or interested party in this because there was still some outstanding obligation, and it's a rule of contract law. You cannot bind someone who's not a specific party to a specific contract. So it's more to do with the history than Transnet getting up one day and decide we want to sell it to themselves. So I think the history is very, very important.
Thank you for that explanation, but also what I'm trying to get at is that if you went the route of a long-term land lease agreement, you would ultimately arrive at the same conclusion rather than actually selling it off completely, because at the end of that period, you still have that piece of land. Thank you.
The nature of the asset was not a long lease. Now what has been transferred is interest in a company to another company. In that whole, let's call it a basket that has been transferred, certain rights were already created. So you couldn't start changing the rights. And I think that is the argument that's been put forward by the Gauntlet in his submission, is that those are the nature of the rights. We cannot change that. What the request is to this committee is to consider accommodating them as a conditional arrangement to complete the picture.
Do you want to say something?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. I just want to check with Transnet. You say you endorse the proposal on the table. Are you saying by implication that there are no other areas in your ports along the South African coast that you are concerned about? Because I'll be very surprised if there are not other areas that are also need attention. And it might be useful for the department if you can come back to us with a complete list that will help us in the draft. Thank you.
On the report,
Chair,
as I said, just a broad question towards the whole committee there, notwithstanding the very important issues that has been raised by Transnet and Advocate Gauntlet and his team, and I think you agree, we've spent sort of 2 hours on this issue, and I say as an important, and we have a very big bill, so there are a lot of other issues that in the bill that I hope we also give a lot of attention to. Mr. Dubb has raised many very good issues. And I think while this issue needs to be resolved, we going forward mustn't allow it to be the only issue in the bowl. But I mean, I state the obvious, but I don't know that.
Consequences that actually proceed.
that's what I just say, let me say that. Do you think for cities? Now, we don't have a situation where people are saying, but you're just too quick to pass this economic management agreement for the city. Do you think for cities that if you make an exception in certain times, with the regular idea of the government, and that's not the problem, why wouldn't you just ask your colleagues that wrong? Precisely because the third one here is at the same end of the way. I hope it's sent in something for the cities. But then, what about the cities?
Thank you. another couple of years. You can both of them.
And I want to make sure that I'm not going to go.